From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. An official at the Justice Department is now saying the redacted Mueller report is expected to be released Thursday morning. Teams of President Trump's personal lawyers are already in place to speed read the more than 300-page report on the investigation into connections between the Trump campaign and Russia interference in the 2016 election. This morning, President Trump tweeted, "They spied on my campaign. We will never forget." But he also praised the great intelligence that Trump claims exonerated him of both collusion and obstruction of justice, even though the bar summation of the report said Mueller couldn't decide if there was no obstruction of justice. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing is here, and we'll link you, by the way, to his great piece, "The Mueller Report is Coming. Here's What You Need to Know." Hi, Phil.
Hi.
So Thursday, now we'll be looking for the redacted report. To the president's tweet today, Attorney General Barr brought up his concern about spying on the Trump campaign in his congressional testimony, although he said he didn't know if it was possibly warranted. Are we hearing a White House sort of pre-report defense?
Well, this is a White House theme from many months standing. It's not a pre-report defense as much as it is a continuation of this leitmotif picked up by the president and his supporters from very early days of this Russia imbroglio, because they say this is about the deep state, this is about conspirators within the FBI and the Justice Department who were so out to get Trump even before he was elected in 2016 that they began to try to shape events internally out of a bias against him. A lot of that has been knocked down. A lot of the accounts given by the FBI and the Justice Department about their own actions have been subsequently stood up, but it's been very profitable politically for the president and his supporters to frame the story in that way, and that's what they're clearly going to continue to do.
Well, we know defenders of the Mueller investigation have been saying, no, this was about investigating after it was learned that there were ties between people on the campaign and Russians. We know a FISA court granted investigators a warrant to surveil former Trump advisor Carter Page because of his Russia contacts only after he left the campaign. He was on CNN's Michael Smirkanis show this past weekend, and he once again called that surveillance illegal. Let's listen.
My office, when I used to work in New York, is right next door to Trump Tower. I was in and out of there quite frequently. The Starbucks coffee, the cafe downstairs. So there was absolutely spying in Trump Tower. There was no question about that.
He's making the tie there between they were spying on me and I used to go to Trump Tower. So will we learn anything in the report, the redacted report, about what really started this investigation?
Well, we know what really started this investigation. For example, there was a great deal of technical evidence collected by Britain's Signals Intelligence Agency, the GCHQ, in 2015 that we've since learned about that traced the path of data from targets in the United States back to Russian computer servers that became part of the attack against the election in 2016. And then, of course, we know the overtures that Trump campaign officials received from Russians and their agents in 2016, offers of help, offers of dirt on Hillary Clinton, off-the-record meetings and so forth. And it was those clues, those hints that led investigators at the FBI to begin the counterintelligence inquiry that we have lived with for so long. It isn't clear to me what Page is talking about when he discusses the Starbucks that's in Trump Tower next to his office. It's not clear what he saw or what he might know about that. But we'll be looking to learn about a lot more about all these details in this redacted report on Thursday morning when it comes out.
Yeah, and many may want to jump right to it. It's supposed to be color-coded. So many might want to jump right to sections about potential presidential obstruction of justice, because we know Mueller laid out evidence for and against but didn't come to a conclusion, as Attorney General William Barr did. What might you be looking for?
Well, I'll be looking for a number of things. On obstruction of justice, the president has been described by people who work for him as talking in a very unique way. And his former attorney, Michael Cohen, said Trump speaks in code. And the question is, are the difficulties with respect to a potential obstruction of justice charge owing to the code the president uses when he talks to people? He doesn't say, "I'm expressly instructing you to take a following action, which I believe will help me in terms of this investigation." Mm. He says, "Wouldn't it be nice if so-and-so were in charge of this part of the investigation?" Or, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting this thing go." In other words, If the questions are difficult, is it because the president has conducted himself in a way that makes it just on this side of the goal line, and do prosecutors view that as being too difficult to try to make a case? And there are a number of other things. We're going to be looking for whether there's evidence about any other types of election interference by the Russian government against the United States in 2016, other than that which we know about already. The special counsel's office has issued an indictment about social media agitation and about the use of cyber attacks to try and release things to embarrass targets. What else did the Russians do? And what other knowledge did the president or people in his orbit have about what were taking place at that time? We know there were all these overtures, meetings, and communications and so forth. How many of them reached Trump himself? And if they did, what action did he take or not take?
Of course, we're waiting to see on Thursday how much of this will be redacted. Just briefly, why is it that Democrats fear that William Barr in particular might redact too much?
Well, the attorney general has been two Democrats acting like an advocate for the president as opposed to an independent officer. He criticized the investigation before he was nominated. He talked about the spying, which is a loaded word we mentioned earlier on. And so for the Speaker of the House and other Democratic leaders, they're very suspicious that Barr is going to be trying to protect the president as opposed to revealing what the special counsel found.
NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Again, we'll link you to his great writing here and now.org. Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
It has been more than a year since China banned the import of some recyclable materials such as mixed paper and plastics. That decision has affected recycling all over the world, including in the U.S. Lower demand for recycled material has led to lower prices, and meanwhile, processing costs remain the same. So many cities and towns are trying to figure out what to do with their recyclables. Lester Graham of Michigan Radio reports on how some communities in Michigan are coping.
Workers are sorting recyclable items on a production line at the southeastern Oakland County Resource Recovery Authority facility.
This guy here is looking for water bottles or that type of material, and that goes in the bin. Everybody else is looking for something different.
That's Jeff McKean, the general manager of SOCRA.
We have 12 member communities. All the recycling from those 12 communities comes here for processing.
SOCRA sells its recyclable materials to brokers who then find buyers on the market. He says occasionally material is shipped overseas, but most of it stays local. The price increases for taking recycled goods to the market is just beginning to be felt in this part of Michigan.
And I'm putting my budget together right now for our next fiscal year. We're on a July 1 fiscal year basis. And we're not going to make as much money as we'd hoped from the sale of our materials. So we have to factor that into our rates for next year.
Instead of crediting its municipalities for the recyclables, actually sending money back to each municipality, SOCRA might have to start charging the cities. They're lucky. Some cities don't have anywhere to turn at all, as rates for recycling processes cost the same, but the market prices are down.
Well, there are not a lot of options, unfortunately. The capacity like we have here for sorting recycling is pretty limited in this area.
Just 23 miles southwest, the Wayne County city of Westland is one of the hardest hit. William Wild is the city's mayor.
We found out back in February that our rate, which was at the time was $18 a ton to recycle, was going to, in 30 days, move to $80 a ton.
Westland had a month-to-month contract. As market prices for recyclable material dropped, the city's rates for pickup and processing more than quadrupled. The city has a high rate of participation among its citizens in the recycling program, and it didn't want to lose that, so Mayor Wild looked into a temporary solution, sending recyclable material to a waste-to-energy incinerator in Detroit. The Westland City Council did not like that idea. In the end, it didn't matter. The incinerator closed just a few weeks later. Now Westland is simply sending its recyclables to the landfill.
There's so many things that are outside of the city of Westland's control because it's a statewide issue. It's a global issue. There's a lot of uncertainties. But in the midterm, we're asking our residents to continue separating trash from recyclables.
Westland residents are not happy about sending recyclable material to the landfill, and officials are getting lots of angry calls. But the people are still separating recyclable materials so they don't get out of the habit. They're hoping for a solution soon.
I was hoping that they wouldn't just abandon it, but I'm pleasantly surprised that our volume's still about the same while it is being landfilled. I think they know that we are looking for other opportunities.
The city is talking with other nearby communities about joining together and bypassing private firms, directly taking their sorted recyclables to the market. Other cities around the state have longer-term contracts. When those contracts expire, those towns might also be facing much higher costs. Communities are going to face some tough decisions: pay more or stop recycling. But many people feel really good about recycling. It makes them feel as if they're actively doing something for the planet. Karen O'Brien is the executive director of the Michigan Recycling Coalition. O'Brien thinks people will be willing to pay a little more for the privilege of curbside recycling. She also thinks people should start thinking about the packaging they're bringing into their homes.
The sheer volume of materials at the end of their life that we dispose of is ever increasing. It's not going down. With the advent of plastics and disposables and single-serve containers and all that kind of stuff. And I hope that as we make decisions, that we make decisions to be better stewards of ourselves, really.
Reducing the need to recycle by not buying goods and throwaway packaging might be the first step to stop the glut of recycled material driving the markets down. For Here and Now, I'm Lester Correa.
This is Holy Week for Christians, and Passover begins Friday for Jews, so it's a time when many people around the world reflect on spiritual matters. The Benedictine nun, Sister Joan Chittister, says reflection is not enough in these times. People need to act on their spiritual beliefs. Sister Joan speaks around the world on matters of faith and social justice, and she's just published a book called The Time Is Now, A Call to Uncommon Courage. She says people's personal faith should be channeled into public action.
We have come to the point, I believe, where we are teaching only half of the morality and the spirituality we need. For Christians, it is relatively easily defined. We have taught the following of Jesus. Jesus the healer. Jesus the one that everybody loved. Jesus the one who cured sick people and talked to the crowds and loved the children. But that's only half of the spirituality that makes for full morality. When you turn that over, what you find on the other side is Jesus the prophet. Not just caring for the sick, but contending with the forces that made people sick, that oppressed people everywhere. So when you lose prophetic spirituality, you lose that edge to your own moral spiritual responsibility to make the world a better place. God created the world, but God didn't complete it. That's the task God left to us.
Okay, so for those who want to take up the challenge, what are the steps toward, as you say, speaking out and speaking out toward what you think is the truth? What do you recommend people do, especially because it's a daunting task to take on so much with people in power, especially if you feel like you don't have a voice?
Well, in the first place, the background for that, the understanding of that, comes to realizing that the separation of church and state does not mean the separation of the soul and the body. We say, I pray. I say my prayers. I go to church regularly. I give money to the poor. I pour soup in the soup kitchen. Nevertheless, have you ever questioned anybody about why we have to serve soup at all? We must bring to our society not just a good heart, but a committed view of what it means to make the world a better place in each of us. What can you do? Well, first of all, you can begin by paying attention to the legislation that is going through either the House or the Senate. You can examine that legislation. Most of all, you can study it this way. Ask who's being advantaged by this particular piece of legislation. Ask who's being left out. Ask yourself, what are the implications of this piece of legislation for the entire country, for the common good? You can join groups. You can form groups. Your best friends, all of them, your accountant, your lawyer, your doctor, your elementary school teacher. You can bring them into the house once a month, and all of you talk about this. Learn what it says. Discuss it. Respond to it. Pass those ideas on.
But these are acts of politics. These are acts of activism. Are they necessarily acts of faith?
Oh, for heaven's sakes, there is no difference between politics and faith. I know that people want to believe that, and I believe that's the heresy of the separation of church and state. It doesn't mean that I live here as a citizen of this country without responsibility for it, a citizen of this country without commitment. If this is a democracy, if we don't want to lose this a piece at a time, then we're going to have to stand up ourselves.
So let me pick up on that, because your dedication in the book, in it you talk about the people who you've met in your years of traveling the world, people who forever seek the truth, defend the weak, bring the peace, always, always, always stand up to protest injustice. The truth is, though, standing up doesn't always mean that justice wins out. I mean, these are my words, not yours, in the dedication. So the things that you feel are unjust might outlast you and your words. So what does that say to you?
Well, it says that's life, and it doesn't absolve my responsibility to be there. Prophecy is a slow-growing seed. It can take years. But God's time is not our time, and our time is not God's time. Mm-hmm. We each have some small piece of life and insight. We've been given those gifts for this purpose. That's a sin against creation, not to use them for the betterment of the entire society. Politics is the way a good people in a good situation live a good life. And that's the essence and the definition of the moral life as well.
There are people who are in power who are, in some parts of the world, perpetrators of violence, suppressing human rights, stifling the free press, who are considered prophets, even by Christians. How do you reconcile that?
Some people can speak and are speaking, but they are not speaking the will of God. And that's why I suggest that you have to ask the question of every single thing that's done publicly. Is what we're doing, is that really how God wants all people to live? God wants them to have food stamps, but God doesn't care about housing? Some people will say, that's politics. I don't have anything to do with that. Somebody else will have to take care of it. Some people will look at it and say, well, that's the way it is now. There's nothing we can do about it. We just accept it. Other people will say, this is not right. We can't have racism. It excludes half the human race. We can't have sexism. It excludes the other half of the human race. We have to realize that maleness is not the fullness of humanity, and whiteness is not the fullness of the color of humanity. And our responsibility is to make our own morality known.
What about people who don't have the voice that you do and don't have the presence that you do? You have done a lot of speaking all around the world. Speak specifically to one part of your book. This Friday is Passover, which Jews observe. You remind us that even Moses was a reluctant prophet.
Oh, I love that story. It's one of my favorite stories. Remember, the word comes to Moses. Moses, I want you to go to the Pharaoh. Tell the Pharaoh to let my people go. And Moses says, not me. I don't speak. I can't do that. Send my brother. Send Aaron. God gets angry at Moses. And he says to him, I'm sending you. I have heard the cry of my people, and I mean to free them. So I'm sending you to Pharaoh. I'll send Aaron, your brother, with you. But you're not going to get out of this just because you think you can beg off your responsibility. Moses is the model of the reluctant prophet. All of the major prophets argued with God about not being able to do this great work. And in every case, God's answer is exactly the same. I am telling you, you are to be a herald in the camp. You are to watch from the top of the tower so that you can let the people know early that they're on the wrong path. God doesn't say to any of the prophets, raise an army. Doesn't say to any of them, undermine the government. God says, warn them. Tell them my will. Remind them who I am. Now, each of us, we're raising children in our homes. We go to clubs. We have Thanksgiving dinners with our families. This is the kind of spiritual conversation that we should be carrying home from our churches. Then that half of our spirituality is grounded, and the second half is let loose in the society so that we can become what we say we are, which is a democratic government in search of the best possible life for all of our people. It can take years. Ask Martin Luther King how many years it takes to free a people. But we also have to remember that time changes nothing. People do.
What do you do with any kind of either reluctance, if you still and ever feel it, but especially with disillusionment?
Well, I can't believe you asked that question. I work with it personally a lot. And I've always said that if I ever drew or created for myself a coat of arms, I can tell you what the signature would say. It would say, if not for me, then because of me. That's a motto I pass on to everybody who's on this station today. If not for us, then because of us. Will we be successful? I don't even know what the word success means, but I do know what faithful means. I do know what committed means, and I do know what responsible means, and we are.
Thank you. Very nice to speak with you, Sister Joan Chittister. Her new book is called The Time Is Now, A Call to Uncommon Courage. Very nice to speak to you again.
Thank you, Lisa. It's been a great conversation.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Emberwave. Emberwave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Emberwave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions in 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
Tiger Woods is a champion once again. On Sunday, the golfer won the 83rd Masters Tournament in Augusta, Georgia. It's Woods' fifth time wearing the green jacket, but this is his first major title in more than a decade. Since Tiger Woods' last Masters win in 2005, he suffered numerous injuries and personal scandals that had many believing his career was over. Well, now he's nearing the record for the most major championships in golf history. For more, we're joined by Jeff Benedict, co-author of the biography Tiger Woods. Jeff, less than 2 years ago, Woods told his fellow golfers that he was done. I wonder how he ever managed this comeback.
That's not a simple answer. I mean, when you consider what he had to come back from, I think when he made that statement, he was looking at the fact that he'd had multiple back surgeries. He'd reached a point physically where he literally couldn't bend over and pick up soap in the shower or tie his shoes. It's almost hard to exaggerate or overemphasize the steepness of his fall. He had the physical disabilities, but he also had a fairly substantial personal setbacks that were well publicized. And so golf's a very mental game. And for him to come back both physically and mentally to where he was yesterday, I I think it's fair to say it could be the greatest comeback in sports.
So, as you said, he had personal difficulties. He went through a divorce. He lost his sponsorships after it was reported he had had numerous extramarital affairs. It was a big fall from grace for a guy who was so much a beloved figure in the public eye. What did he do mentally and physically to come back?
I think one thing he did was he did something that you never see people do who are caught in that situation, is he faced the music in a very public way, and he didn't duck anything. And I think probably coming back from something like that doesn't happen overnight. It could take years, or most people don't come back at all. This is a man who is as down as a human being could be, not only in his profession, but in his personal life. And now he's actually back on top. It's taken him 10 years to get there. And I think that there's a lot of people who may not even care about golf who were cheering for him yesterday, and because there's something in that that people can relate to now, whereas no one could really relate to how great he was earlier in his career because nobody was like that. But there's a lot of people who've been through things that are hard. You look at this guy and you go, geez, you know, maybe I have a chance.
Has his game changed at all? I mean, I know you say it looked like the old Tiger in a good way. Is it different yeah. in any form?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I think that makes him so unusual is how many times he's changed his game and modified his swing. I would compare it to Michael Jordan deciding he's going to shoot left-handed. I mean, when you're at the top of the profession and then you dramatically alter your swing in golf, it's just profound. Tiger Woods has had to do that since the back surgery, for sure.
So now Tiger Woods is within striking distance of the record for the most major championships in golf history. That would be 18. Jack Nicklaus currently holds that record. How well prepped do you think he is to setting the record?
Better than anyone who's ever played since Jack. This is a different Tiger Woods mentally than we've probably ever seen. And he's in great, great shape. I think, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of what he could do over the next few years, assuming he stays healthy.
That's Jeff Benedict, co-author of the biography Tiger Woods, along with Armin Gatayan. Jeff, nice to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
President Trump has threatened to cut off funding for aid groups in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and warned he wants to close the border with Mexico to asylum seekers, even though petitioning for asylum is a privilege guaranteed by law. And though a crisis, most of those arriving at the border now are women with children. Critics of the president's policy say you can't stop them coming until you stop what they're fleeing. Journalist Sonia Nazario is back from a month of reporting in Honduras, and to acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney's question, if aid is working, why are people still coming? She responds, because they don't want to die. Women in particular are dying in horrible ways, so a warning. As we talk about this, it will be disturbing. Sonia Nazario is a contributor to the New York Times. We'll link you to her op-ed at herenow.org. She's also author of the bestseller Enrique's Journey, based on her Pulitzer Prize-winning 2002 series in the Los Angeles Times. She joins us from WYPR in Baltimore. Sonia, welcome back.
Thank you, Robin. Glad to be here.
There's a stunning sentence in your reporting. You write, unlike in much of the world where murdered women are killed by husbands or family members, half of those murdered in Honduras are killed by drug cartels and gangs, and they're being killed in ways that are horrifying, shot in the female body part, cut to bits with their parts distributed among various public places, strangled in front of their children, skinned alive. You know, what do you say right off the bat to people who say, oh, come on, that's just a partisan exaggeration?
Well, I've been a reporter for 3 decades and been in some of the most deadly places in the world, and I was scared out of my wits. 4 out of 10 women in Honduras, when they're murdered, are mutilated. They're killed with a cruelty that goes beyond what is needed to kill them. I mean, everyone in the neighborhood where I spent time in Honduras knew about the 2 women who had been killed in 2017, and one of them had been skinned alive, and then they had left their body parts in three different places. The torso was missing. Women repeatedly told me, I only go out to get food and to go to my job and return from my job. Yeah. I am scared to death, and I believe them.
There was a 2015 survey that ranked Honduras as one of the world's deadliest places to be a woman, up there with El Salvador and Syria. 380 Honduran women murdered last year. But this is a country that has a population of New York City, and it goes deep into the government structure. I mean, you start off talking about an agent for what's essentially Honduras's FBI, which is supposed to investigate the killings of women. What happened?
Well, they're supposed to investigate the killings of women, but in the case of an agent for the FBI, she appears to have been murdered by one of the leaders of this agency. So the agency that's supposed to protect women actually has leaders that are killing them and then trying to cover up, making it look like it was a suicide, and it clearly was not a suicide. This agency of the FBI didn't allow anyone else at the crime scene, which has never been done before. Usually there's three or four different groups that investigate. The crime scene was clearly altered. Her phone moved three times and then ended up conveniently in a jar of water, and it turns out that she was likely murdered by one of the heads of this FBI agency. And the women who tried to tell the truth at the morgue, saying, no, this was a homicide, it wasn't a suicide, soon found themselves being followed by a group of sicarios, killers, supposedly by this FBI group.
Well, and these women have applied for asylum. I mean, that's a perfect example of women who are trying to flee the violence in Honduras. But you go on. So that's, you know, deep within the government structure. But, you know, there's a man who took a machete to his wife's feet.
Right. So a lot of the murders occur by gangs or drug cartels because women are being recruited to sell drugs. They think that somebody is more likely to buy drugs from a woman who's flirting and less likely to be suspect by the police. And they're being recruited forcefully into those jobs in many cases. They don't have an option. Also, there's just the hyper machismo of places like Honduras. And I interviewed a woman, Heidi Hernandez, whose husband wouldn't let her step outside the home without permission. One day he put a machete to her throat and made her kneel with their three young children and threatened to kill her. And then finally one day she came home a half hour late and he pulled out the machete from under the bed and started hacking into the back of her legs 10 times and cut off parts of both of her legs in front of her 8-year-old daughter, Maybelle, who was screaming, "Daddy, don't kill her." That man was charged with inflicting light lesions. Light lesions. I mean, this woman lost both legs and her heart stopped twice and she nearly died. And only when the daughter went to visit dad at the prison and dad said, "Well, when I get out, I'm going to finish her off," did they add 20 more years. So yeah. Often there is no reprisals for men who kill women. 9 in 10 of these murders get no justice, get no court date, you know, no verdict.
Well, and as you say, prosecutors who do their jobs often end up dead. Women who are being assaulted either by gangs or husbands have no place to hide, no shelters. In domestic abuse cases, women are sometimes told to deliver their own restraining orders. And just tell us more. You've given us quite a few suggestions why, but what are the other reasons this is happening?
I think that the sadism that I saw in Honduras towards killing women is a way of showing to women men's power, that they're all powerful, and showing this to rival men. And the extremes to which they go and the ways that they kill women is trying to instill terror in their enemies, both by gangs and by these drug cartels that are rampant, especially in northern Honduras. Mm-hmm. And because there are no investigations of these murders for various reasons, corruption amongst the various agencies that are supposed to investigate, the police, the judges, many are bought off, incompetence. You know, a lot of these positions are political positions, so they don't really know what they're doing. Lack of resources. I mean, the prosecutors are investigating 300 murders of women each. That's impossible. Mm. And just a lack of interest in doing the work. I spent time at the morgue in this northern city in Honduras, and they do an autopsy report and an initial investigation, and prosecutors don't even pick up four or five of these reports that would be the start of an investigation. So there's just a lack of interest by the state in protecting women, and some members of the state are killing these women. And so these women aren't going to stay in Honduras and be slaughtered.
Yeah, no wall is going to keep them out either,
no.
You say. Well, when it comes to the aid money, most of it goes to these aid groups, some of it to the government itself. Well, we spoke to a critic. She's not for cutting off the funding. This is Anita Isaacs. We'll link it at hereandnow.org. But is for more accountability on the part of the government, which is in most cases corrupt. More demanding that, as you say, and as women's groups there are demanding, that the U.S., as a condition of aid to the government, require Honduras commit a percentage of its budget to holding abusers and killers accountable. The picture you paint, though, there would have to be a wholesale change of who's in these public offices because so many are corrupt.
Yeah, and I think that that's possible. There's been a purge of the police in Honduras. They fired about 5,000 out of 12,000 cops. There needs to be a purge of the other institutions, the prosecutors, the judges, the military police. I think that we need to actually increase aid and have a Marshall Plan of sorts. But I think your other guess is right. We need an actual plan. We need to make sure that the money is well spent, coordinated, not in this hodgepodge of programs that we have now that have been kind of thrown together. I mean, we don't even have a ambassador in Honduras. We have a chargé d'affaires who leaves every few months to go on military duty. We need to actually focus on this rather than putting up concertina wire at the border. If we spend millions of dollars in Honduras, it's actually cheaper than spending money when folks arrive at our southern border asking for safety and asking for help. So I think instead of focusing all of our attention on this wall and concertina wire, we need to focus attention on how do you set up the most effective program to bring about change, bring better lives for women, more sex ed in schools in Honduras, and provide a bargaining chip for reforms by the government to purge people who are corrupt, and target the killers of these women, provide incentives to do that. There are many things that we can do that we are not doing.
Sonia Nazario, and we'll link you to the result of her month-long reporting in Honduras at hereandnow.org. Sonia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm still stuck on the fact that women have been skinned alive. Your thoughts welcome on what you just heard. Here now.
Today is tax day. The Internal Revenue Service has endured years of budget cuts, and it's now in the throes of a political fight over President Trump's tax returns, which he has not released to the public. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us as he does each Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
Over the weekend, House Democrats tried to ratchet up the pressure and gave the IRS an April 23rd deadline to release the president's tax returns. Tell us what happens behind the scenes. How does the IRS commissioner go about deciding whether or not to release the president's returns?
It's interesting because typically on tax day, the IRS stands between millions of households and their income. Why is this year different from all other years? Well, this year, the IRS stands between the Democrats in the House and the White House. And the fight here, as you laid out, is pretty simple. House Democrats want to see Donald Trump's tax returns. And the White House wants to resist those efforts at any cost. So the IRS is a part of the Treasury Department. That department is overseen by the Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin. And Mnuchin has resisted Democrats strongly. So it's interesting here because it's pretty common for voters to see the president's tax returns. In fact, many of the Democratic candidates for president have already released their returns. But in this case, as in so many cases, under Trump, the IRS has been, again, politicized.
But if you take away the politics, aren't there clear rules about this?
Yes, well, there is a procedure. The procedure that's happening now is that Representative Richard Neal, who's chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, he sends a request to the IRS commissioner. But the IRS commissioner essentially is under Mnuchin, and Mnuchin has essentially slow-walked that request. He's essentially said, I think this is very complicated. There's a lot of things that we have to make sure we don't release if we do release these tax returns. So he's walking this very slowly. And the House, in return, has sent a letter to the IRS saying that Mnuchin's concerns lack merit. So they're basically going back and forth and back and forth, essentially trying to create a deadline on the House side to accelerate this process, and then on the White House side, they're essentially trying to delay any possible discovery of the president's tax returns, which the Democrats have been trying to learn about for the last 4 years.
So, as somebody who watches the IRS closely, how political do you think it's become in recent years?
I think it's become extraordinarily political. I mean, Trump politicizes everything that he touches, and then Trump's opponents politicize everything that Trump touches as well. I think that the reason that this fight is so important, both for the Trump White House and for Democrats, is that there was hope among Democrats that the Mueller report was going to provide ammunition for their party to take down the president. But the Barr summary of that report, however, said no collusion, no conspiracy, and no hard evidence of obstruction of justice. We'll see what the report itself says when the redacted version is released on Thursday. But the thinking among Democrats is that Trump's tax returns might provide for Democrats that which the Mueller report did not, which is proof of malfeasance, possible proof of violations of the Emoluments Clause. It's not entirely clear what we'll find. But again, I do think it's important to say that, yes, this is a political skirmish, but it is also customary for presidents and even presidential candidates to allow the public to see their tax returns.
So the IRS as an agency has seen, as we said, years of budget cuts. The number of auditors has dropped to under 10,000. It did so in 2017, according to Bloomberg News. That's the lowest level since the 1950s, a time when the agency was far smaller than it is now. Audits are at a 15-year low. What are some of the other consequences of the cuts?
The sad thing is that we don't entirely know what the consequences of these cuts are going to be. Because one thing that a beefed-up, well-staffed IRS does is it cracks down on white-collar crime. It exposes white-collar crime, and then it cracks down on it. And so if you have a bureaucracy like the IRS that's essentially on life support, what you're going to get, I would suspect, is a lot of white-collar crime run amok. A lot of people, not especially rich people, not paying their taxes, finding ways out of their tax bill. But the IRS won't have the staff to crack down on that crime and provide for the government the revenue that is rightfully theirs. So I do think that in general, we tend to hate on the IRS. We tend to have this instinct that we want to starve them for funds. They're the police of our own household budgets. But I think it would behoove us to say, if what we want to do is crack down on white-collar crime – and even reduce the amount of time that it takes us ordinary households to do our taxes, what we should hope for, ironically, is a strong IRS that supports the public interest.
Why do you think that, as you have said, that the government should do our taxes for us?
Well, about half of American households earn all of their income from an employer's wages, so the W-2, which an IRS can see, or interest from one bank, which the IRS can easily find out. So the IRS could easily just send tens of millions of Americans, let's say 70 million Americans, a completed tax form by mail, by even text, and it could just say, sign on the dotted line. Bingo. Taxes would be done in 15 seconds. Other countries do this. In Sweden, the vast majority of taxpayers don't do battle, don't have warfare every March and April with their tax documents with these fine print questions and these itemized deductions. They just get a document from their government that has all the relevant information right there on the paper, and they sign on the dotted line. We could do this. We could save millions, billions of dollars and thousands of hours if we simply let the IRS do our work for us. But to do that, we need a fully staffed bureaucracy.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Nice to speak with you.
Good to speak with you, too.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.